Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to find out about the difference between spring water, tap water, and distilled water. Which are the best? Also, we're going to look at olive oil and the compounds in it that they can now prove can kill cancer cells in as little as 30 minutes. And also, I mentioned yesterday, didn't have a chance to cover it, but I will today. Sitting too long, it does a lot of problems to your body. I'll discuss that. And also, ways to speed up your metabolism that is really easy. I met a person on the street, a stranger who recognized me and said, "Gary, I'm so busy all the time. I have 6 kids. I'm overweight. I used to be athletic. I'm not now. I feel rotten. My blood sugar is up. My blood pressure is up. My cholesterol is up. Is there anything that I could do just to get started? I can't do it all." Sure, there's a lot you can do. I'll be sharing that with you in the way of simple essential oils that will help stimulate a healthier metabolism. Also today, many of you in this audience have emailed talking about what's become of our country. Do we have fascism? Do we have a police state? Well, it depends upon your perspective. Many people, if not the majority of Americans, would never assume that we have fascism because they don't see the book burnings. They don't see the large Nuremberg rallies. They don't see the sirens whisking up and down the street, collecting any dissident and putting him in detention camps. And because they don't see these things, they think we still have a vibrant democracy, the best in the world. Well, today, I'll share a different perspective upon what I believe is the new form of American authoritarianism. And that authoritarianism is really just another word for fascism, but it is not the Hitler-Mussolini fascism. It's not even McCarthy fascism. It is different. Professor Henry Giroux, Counterpunch, The Plague of American Authoritarianism. My guest in the second part of our program, Kermit Hartsong, H-E-A-R-T-S-O-N-G, Hartsong. He is an empirical scientist. He is an award-winning creator of games, and he is also an investigator of macroscopic developments of social, economic, and political systems. He's a very bright man. And he will be talking about an update on the U.S.-Russia-Ukrainian standoff. Ask the average American, they simply don't know what it's about. More often than not, they'll say, well, isn't that Russia trying to steal the Ukraine, the United States standing up to him and putting NATO on that border to prevent that? That's what we're told, but it's not the truth. So we'll learn the truth today. He also wrote a very important book about America's dystopian illusions for the future called Ukraine, the big grand chessboard and how the West was checkmated. So we'll talk with him today. And if time permits, we are the government. Tactics for challenging the police state. Let's begin. Once a person, male or female, gets above, let's say, 40, about every 10 years, your metabolism slows down a bit. Now, depending upon how athletic you are, how much you walk, how vigorous your muscles are, your diet, the quality and length of your sleep, whether you're taking nutrients, you're normal or overweight, you're stressed or distressed to an extreme, whether you have chronic illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, cancers, or acute illnesses like major infections, all of this will determine the state of your metabolism. Also, your thyroid gland determines the state of your metabolism. And as a person gets older, the thyroid slows down. It's just not as efficient. Imagine for most of your life you were a 12-cylinder car. You could move. Uphill, downhill didn't matter. But every decade after 30, you take one of those spark plugs out. So now one day you're running on two spark plugs and you're having a hard time getting through the day. Now, ideally, we should give ourselves about 2 years to fully and completely detoxify, because that's how long it takes, using natural and medical chelation techniques to get rid of the heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury. Every one of those cans of tuna, well, they were lead-lined. And as a result, you have lead. The silver fillings in your mouth, the amalgam fillings, that's 52% mercury. As a result, you have mercury fillings. Those are leaching every time you bite food or drink a beverage. It goes into the brain and the bloodstream. When you eat fish from the ocean, you're getting mercury also. So it's not difficult to load up our body with all forms of heavy metals. You get a vaccine, you're getting aluminum right in there. Most deodorants also have aluminum. Most of your lightweight cooking ware is aluminum. And when you're cooking anything at high temperatures or that's acidic, it leaches into what you're cooking. You won't taste it. You won't know it's there. Your body will. Why? Because the body has no mechanism for using it. And any time the body can't use something, it either has to try to expel it or it stores it in fat tissue. Hence, the more overweight you are, the more fatty tissue you have, the more toxic you are. And you will end up developing diseases. It is absolute and inevitable. It is not humanly possible. It is not scientifically possible to be overweight and to be healthy. Now, we don't like people to feel that they're somehow being punished or blaming them for being overweight. And there are many reasons to be overweight. In fact, I did a documentary on PBS called It's Not Your Fault, You're Fat, which I explained being allergic to a food could cause you to hold weight. In any case, it is important that you understand that when you are overweight, you are far more susceptible to diabetes, heart disease, stroke, cancers, depression, and autotoxemia. So, we want to change our metabolism, speed it up, and just visualize your metabolism as a thermostat. And it's really cold outside, and you have the thermostat at 60, so it's cold inside. You want to start getting warm inside, you raise the thermostat to 75, and now it's warm inside. That's your thyroid gland. When it's really working well, you have a faster, more healthy metabolism, you're going to burn more calories, your whole body is going to function better. So how do we speed it up if we can't do everything? And not everyone can do everything. Here's one thing you can do. It's inexpensive and easy, completely non-toxic. You can begin to use essential oils. Now, the essential oil comes from the plant. It may be the leaf. It may be the sap from a twig, a root. It can be various parts. But it's the oil, and that's what we want. These are organic compounds, and they have extraordinarily strong healing properties. And they're light, they're easy to use. For example, there's some essential oils that are good at curbing appetite, others helping your digestion, others giving you a better mood. If you are having trouble sleeping, I would say put 2 drops of either. You could use lemongrass, which is good, or eucalyptus on your pillow. And just those 2 drops on the pillow is enough for the pheromones, the little molecules that are escaping and releasing their aroma, for you to smell. And that sends off receptors in the brain and central nervous system, which relax you. Why do you think we love the smell of apple pie with cinnamon on top? Because these take us back to a time when our mothers were making us something. We associated the food, like apple pie, with our mother and love and being cared for and appreciated. So now it's 60 years later, and you smell it instantaneously. Those memory cells reignite and match a current day phenomenon or stimulus to back then. So don't underestimate oils. They work. So what do we want to do? We want to inhale them. Not put them on our body, but just inhale them. And then there are some we can take. We could put them in our bath. For example, if you put peppermint oil, as directed on the bottle, into the bath, that can help two things. 10 drops of peppermint essential oil into your relaxing bath, can some of that will be absorbed through your skin, but also it will improve your metabolism and it will lessen your food cravings. Ginger oil is a well-known oil because of what is called the gingerol, G-I-N-G-E-R-O-L. That's a powerful anti-inflammatory, but it also increases thermogenesis. Hence, that helps your metabolism, so you'll burn fat faster. Now, you could put 2 drops of ginger oil in your favorite herbal tea, like green tea. Grapefruit oil, it's terrific for you. It suppresses appetite. It helps burn fat. It prevents bloating and water retention, and it increases metabolism. You can either inhale it from a dispenser, or you could drink it by putting a couple drops into a glass of juice. Peppermint oil is extremely beneficial. It's an anti-inflammatory, but it also stimulates your metabolism, and it helps calm and upset stomach, and helps you if you have bloating and gas and indigestion. Again, you can inhale it, or you can take a few drops. Also, we have bergamot, bergamot. Bergamot it has a wonderful scent, and it relaxes you. It lifts your mood. And it has polyphenols found in green tea, which helps boost metabolism, and it helps burn fat. Also, you have cinnamon oil. And cinnamon oil is just terrific for your metabolism, and also it suppresses appetite. You could take a couple drops into, let's say, a tea, and then lemon oil. Lemon oil is one of my favorite. In fact, if I'm doing a long drive, I will take some lemon oil, and I'll put it in a diffuser, and it improves your sense of calm, but it improves your metabolism. And it's just one of those great scents that we are invigorated, helps with mental clarity. So those are some things that you could do that don't cost much money. You can buy these oils for $7 to $10, and they're easy to do. All right? Now, one of the things that people have a problem with is getting up from their work during the day and doing a little exercise. I recommend that you simply do this to make it easy. Get yourself one of these inexpensive little timers. They go off every 2 hours. It quietly goes off. It can vibrate or give you a little ting-ting. And you then get up for maybe 5 minutes. Walk around, do some half squats, go heel-toe, heel-toe, so that you're forcing the muscles to constrict and relax, constrict and relax. Breathe deeply, oxygenate your tissues. That's good for you, but you really have to do it about every 2 hours. Why? Because sitting too long is really bad. Also, there are over 34 million Americans who have office or sales jobs, forcing them to remain sedentary for long periods of time. According to a report in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the average person spends more than half of their waking hours in an inactive state at a computer, watching television, commuting to and from work. Well, that is not good. Now, there's a lot of downside to this. First, you start to pool blood into the lower extremities. That's varicosities. That can end up exacerbating intermittent claudication, pains in the calf. It reduces circulation to your brain, hence the microcirculation your brain needs to maintain cognition and healthy brain. You're not getting. You need good quality oxygenation of blood from your heart and lungs to all the tissues in your body. You're not getting it. So remember, when you move your muscles, you're moving blood and oxygen and the nutrients that they contain and waste debris, taking it out. That gives you clarity of thought, sharper mind. And when you have slow oxygenation, slow blood, that's an inability and a clarity of thought. So give yourself a break. Also, it's bad for your back. That's why we have poor postures, which contributes to back pain, inflexible spines, disc damage. And also moving around causes soft discs between vertebrae in the spine to expand and contract, allowing blood and nutrients in. When you're sitting too long, the discs become uneven and compact, even causing collagen to build up around tendons and ligaments. And it causes muscle degeneration. When you're not using muscles, you're losing muscles. Also, when you're using your muscles, you're developing a greater flexibility. And that's important. Also, when you're moving, your organs are being improved and lessening the risk of heart disease, cardiovascular, colon cancer, and other problems. And leg disorders are at the top of the list. So if you want healthier ankles, feet, no swollen ankles, varicose veins, blood clots, you got to move the muscles. And finally, from Green Med Info, we now know that extra virgin olive oil is phenomenal, but a new study shows that one phenolic compound called EVOO, oleocanthal, provides many of the health benefits we see from diets rich in the Mediterranean diet. And recently, researchers put this EVOO to the test against cancer. They found that the phytochemical in olive oil was able to induce rapid death in cancer cells, but left all the healthy cells intact. This was done by a joint venture at Hunter College and Rutgers University, and also Monell Chemical Synthesis Center. They investigated the effects of the oleocanthal on prostate, breast, and pancreatic cancer cells. They found that the oleocanthal induced the loss of cell adhesion within as little as 30 minutes. Within 24 hours, 100% of the cancer cells were non-viable. Now, oleocanthal, A-O-L-E-O, oleocanthal, C-A-N-T-H-A-L, works on lysosomes within the cancer cells. And the lysosomes are small organelles, which are the cell's first line of defense against viruses and bacteria. They're also the place where cells store waste. Cancer cells have fragile lysosomal membranes comparable to healthy cells. And so the oleocanthal from olive oil breaks open the membrane around the lysosomes in cancer cells, but leaves the non-cancer cells intact. And that means then they're easy to kill, easy for them to die. So, in lay language, olive oil, known throughout history as the oil of youth, lowers your risk of heart attack, stroke, and turns off genes that turn on heart disease and inflammation. And now we know also that it helps allow the body to kill cancer cells. That is important. So always make sure that you buy the best olive oil. Don't go cheap on it, because olive oil is expensive to grow and process, So if you're getting a cheap oil, there's a possibility you're not getting the real McCoy. And also, always look for DOP, a certified Italian oil. You might think your olive oil is Italian. More often than not, it isn't. About 40% of bottles labeled Italian originated in other countries like Spain, Greece, and Tunisia. And always look the country of origin. If you want to know what country it comes from, always look at DOP. And that's important. That is, D stands for your designation, O for origin, and P for protected. That means those are olives are grown, harvested, processed, and shipped from the place listed on the label. And avoid all light olive oils. Light and extra light olive oils, highly refined. Get the dark, extra virgin olive oil. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. With us, everyone. I was walking down Broadway, as I normally do in the evening, to relax and refocus my thoughts and before I start counseling, and I walked by the Beacon Theater. There's Earth, Wind, and Fire. So I went in. They had a ticket left upstairs. Beautiful theater if you've never been there. Great renovation they do. It's small enough so you're up close to the stage, but it's grand enough to sense that old world charm and the great architecture. And what amazed me about Earth, Wind, and Fire is, first, I had forgotten how many hits they had. And secondly, they are as good today as I heard them way back in California, a long time ago at the beginning of their career. They are an act to see, great performers. In any case, if you are ever wanting to listen to this show and you're out and about, you can always, at noon Eastern Standard Time, anywhere in North America, including Canada, you can call a number and listen in. And that number is 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. And we're number one of all radio stations in North and South. If I can ever help you in raising, let me know. Happy to do it. And because I know that you're non-commercial, you serve the interests of your audience, and anytime you need an extra hand, just let me. So we did this for them, and we had a chance to meet some remarkable people. One woman came in from South Africa. Yeah. And you'll hear in her own words about her. But someone in a discussion, I've been having these mini lectures throughout the day. This morning I had one for about an hour and a half on a particular theme about don't judge someone by what you think they're about. Unless you know them, you don't know what they're about. And I gave some examples of that. For example, I mentioned, you've seen this man here all week. You know, you see him out there with Cruz, the caretaker of this particular piece, and he's working. Do you know he's a doctor? He's a physician. He came here because there was a time when his mother needed help, and we gave his mother help in his hour of need. And without being encouraged or asked, he said, "Can I volunteer to help?" You might not know that about him. You didn't know he was a physician. We've had several physicians here. And so we, as a society, not individually, but as a society, we're too quick to judge something by the image rather than the substance of that being. And that said, there was a discussion where a person said, "I don't understand the lecture you gave the other night on Monday night. You made it seem like we don't have a whole lot of freedom. And I want to differ with you because you said challenge you if you feel that there's a point of challenge. Now, I'm going to challenge you. I believe that we have a thriving, abundant democracy." And I said, "Fair enough. Let us explore it then. Define democracy to me. Define your freedoms and how you express them to me." And for the next 15 minutes, this person did a very good job, very articulate, very insightful, and very thoughtful of explaining their concept of democracy. And they were absolutely correct about everything they said. Then I said, "Have you ever been to a soup kitchen? Have you ever been to a center for children suffering from cancer, pediatric cancer ward? Have you ever had your assets confiscated? Have you ever spoken with anyone who's been in a debtor's prison? Have you ever spoken to anyone who went to jail for having more than 100 grams of marijuana and spent the next 12 years there? Have you ever had any form of assault by a gang? Are you aware that every phone call you've been making, you have the freedom to make the call, but the government has the freedom to monitor and listen in, record it, and then they exponentially make a list of every person that you've spoken to in 5 years, and then they make a list of everyone that person has spoken to within 5 years. And they go back and they get every single call that you have made to any person that person's made to you, and then they start seeing, is there connections, and what are the connections? And then they have psychologists analyze those connections. Have you ever protested anything? Would you like to protest anything? Well, yeah, there's some things I would like to protest. Have you ever? No, I haven't. So you're living in a democracy, but you've never found the time or the interest to protest that which is unfair, whatever it may be. Citizens United is unfair, or usurious interest rates on credit cards that you miss a payment, or a payday loan, 1,000% interest, or a debit card at 280% interest. If you miss, don't have the money to cover it, are those fair? And were you aware that you were being monitored? Are you aware that anyone who protests anything in the United States now goes on a domestic terrorist list that is kept by the National Security Agency and Homeland Security? Were you aware of this? And that got to a deeper discussion about how, depending upon where you live and the quality of your life and what you're exposed to, you could rightly claim that you're not aware of what some call creeping fascism, others called, like Sheldon Wolin, inverted totalitarianism, but what Professor Henry Giroux from Counterpunch calls American authoritarianism. No matter what label you give it, we should just take a moment and pause, because authoritarianism in the American collective psyche and in what might be called the traditional narratives of historical memory is always viewed as existing elsewhere, viewed as an alien and demagogic political system. It is primarily understood as a mode of governance associated with the dictatorships in Latin America in the 1970s, like Pinochet or one of the others in the Middle East. And its most vile extremes, yeah, then intone Hitler's poisonous Nazi rule and Mussolini's fascist state in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. These were and are societies that idealized what? Now here's where we have to take a moment and pause. What do we as a society, not individually, not certainly for many of the people in this audience, but as a society, what do we idolize today? We idolize narcissism, excessive violence, war, celebrity culture, the militarization of life, nationalism, political certainty, fallen heroes, racial cleansing, and a dogmatic allegiance to the homeland. What do not we now spend time idealizing? The quality and capacity for critical thinking, which was the foundational principle of all education. The liberal arts, music, and drama, and literature, and the understanding of classic philosophy. Those are from a bygone era, but part of the intrinsic ability to reason and understand the contextual fabric that you are woven into in our society. We do not value character, honesty. As a society, we have so accustomed ourselves to the lie, the big lie, the little lie, the political lie, the media lie, the distortion, the biases. We have it in the mainstream media and we have it in alternative media. We say we pride ourselves in freedom of speech. And yet, if you're a reporter or a commentator and you want to tell the full truth based upon full exposure of all the evidence, more often than not, you either self-censor or be censored. So where do we go for our freedom of speech? We go to a non-commercial Pacifica station, such as KPFA in Los Angeles, that historically absolutely honored the value of a person coming forward and sharing a point of view, irrespective of how radicalized it was, and the opportunity to have that valued view challenged by another view, an open forum for critical thought from which the public had the opportunity to decide if any, either, or none of these voices represented meaningful discourse. And leading in championing women's rights and freedom of speech and freedom of thought, and understanding you are a voice of the voiceless. And that, all of the Pacifica stations maintained for decades, all from the great mind of Lewis Hill, who founded it. Today, many of these very same stations, such as KPFK in Los Angeles, has people on there who view themselves more as demagogues and promote the official agendas and vaccination and the drugging of our children, and the same is true for other commentators, which is their absolute right. Now ask those people to debate me or someone else in an open forum, and we're told, A, we're not going to debate you on any of these issues, or you have no right to have that information on our air. What happened to freedom of choice? Is that democracy in action? Because I thought democracy also made room for freedoms, including freedom of speech. So now that falls under the idea of authoritarianism. Those in power dictate how much freedom to be expressed and by whom and on what level. And that which is contrary to their views is excluded. So we have it on NPR, we have it on PBS, we have it on mainstream media, and now, of course, we have it on the final bastion of the radio stations, except for the Progressive Radio Network, which we still value that, and that's why we have more people listening and coming than the others combined. But now imagine what we don't value. We don't value the feminist spiritual message. We do not value those who are not giving us any form of doomsday message, but rather they're giving us clarion calls. They're saying, pay attention to what you're doing. You can go to an environmental movement and see all the people protesting also using things that will be disposed of and contribute to the pollution and the escalation. They're eating McDonald's. They're eating pork. They're eating chicken. They're eating fish. And that is causing methane gases and contributing. But we do not value in our society the vegan, the conscientious vegan, the healthy vegan that wants not only to protect the life of the animal, but also the life of a human from heart disease and cancers, and the life of the planet from tearing down rainforest to the lungs of the planet to grow soybeans to feed to the hogs and the cattle so more affluency can spread more environmental destruction. But look at the hypocrisy within the environmental movement. Look where their money comes from and look what they no longer value. Freedom to express ideas that could help change the outcome. Education and the media were the propaganda tools of authoritarianism, merging fascist and religious symbols with the language of God and family and country. Of the return of an updated authoritarianism turns the potential threat of the return of authoritarianism into dead memory. Hence, any totalitarian mode of governance is now treated as a relic of a sealed past that bears no relationship to the present. The need to retell the story of totalitarianism becomes a frozen lesson in history rather than a narrative necessary to understanding the present. Historical conjunctures produce different forms of authoritarianism, though they all share a hatred for democracy, dissent, and human rights. It is too easy to believe in a simplistic, binary logic that strictly categorizes a country or as either authoritarian or democratic, but leaves no room for entertaining the possibility of a curve, of a mixture of both systems. American politics today suggests a more updated, if not different, form of authoritarianism, or what some have called the curse of totalitarianism. In this context, it is worth remembering that Huey Long, remember him, governor of Louisiana, and later a legislator, said in a response to the question of whether America could ever become fascistic, quote, "Yes, but we will call it anti-fascist." Long's reply indicates that fascism is not an ideological apparatus frozen in a particular historical period. Rather, it is complex and shifting theoretical and political register for understanding how democracy can be subverted, if not destroyed from within. The notion of soft fascism was articulated in 1985 in Bertram Gross's book, Friendly Fascism, in which he argued that if fascism came to the United States, it would not embody the same characteristics associated with fascist forms in the historical past. No Nuremberg rallies, no doctrines of racial superiority, no government-sanctioned book burnings, no death camps, genocidal purges, or the abrogation of the Constitution. In short, fascism would not take the form of an ideological grid from the past simply downloaded onto another country under different historical conditions. Gross believed that fascism was an ongoing danger and had the ability to become relevant under new conditions, taking on familiar forms of thought that resonate with traditions and experiences and political relations. Similarly, in his Anatomy of Fascism, Robert Paxton argued that the texture of American fascism would not mimic traditional European forms of fascism, but would be rooted in the language, the symbols, and the culture of everyday life. No swastikas in American fascism, but stars and stripes. No book burning, but Christian crosses. No fascist salute, but mass resuscitation to the Pledge of Allegiance. These symbols contain no whiff of fascism in themselves, but of course, think of American fascism and how it would transform them into obligatory litmus tests for detecting the internal enemy. It is worth noting that Umberto Eco, in his discussion of eternal fascism, also argued that any updated versions of fascism would not openly assume the mantle of historical fascism. Rather, new forms of authoritarianism would appropriate some of its elements, making it virtually unrecognizable from its traditional forms. He contended that fascism, if it comes to America, will have a different guise, although it will be no less destructive of democracy. I had on this program, on several occasions, one of the greatest political theorists of all time, Sheldon Whalen. Professor Whalen claimed that in the United States, an emerging totalitarianism has appeared in a form different from what we have seen in the past. Instead of the charismatic leader, the government is now governed through the anonymous and largely remote hands of corporate power and finance capital. Political sovereignty is largely replaced by economic sovereignty as corporate power takes over the reins of governance. The more money influences politics, the more corrupt the political culture becomes. And under such circumstances, holding office is largely dependent upon having huge amounts of capital at one's disposal. While laws and policies at all levels of government are mostly fashioned by lobbyists representing big business corporations and financial institutions. Think of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. For 35 years, no one knew where they existed except the 200 major Fortune 500 companies that belonged to it, and they met twice a year at exclusive resorts in the states where your legislature exists and gave them bills that became laws. Not once, not one time in 35 years did any legislature come forward and say, I'm not going to do this. That would be a betrayal of the principles by which I was elected to serve my constituents. Instead, every one of these lobbyists was able to get bills passed, over 22,000 laws that we know of, never helping the public, always helping corporate interest. Moreover, as the politics of Obama's health care reform indicate, a gift to the health insurance giants, such as lobbying, as corrupt and unethical as it may be, is now carried out in the open and displayed by insurance and drug companies as a badge of honor, a kind of open testimonial to the disrespect for democratic governance and a celebration of their power. And on the right, they have Fox and conservative media hosts. On the left, they have MSNBC and Mother Jones and Rachel Maddow and all the people who've abrogated true liberalism for corporate liberalism, and hence they've dressed up their package so attractively and articulately that those in the democratic movement are not even aware of the seduction. So rather than forcing a populace to adhere to a particular state ideology, the general public in the United States is largely depoliticized through the influence of corporations over schools, higher education, and all cultural apparatuses. The deadening of public values and civil consciousness and critical citizenship are also the result of the work of the anti-public intellectuals representing both the left and the right wing ideological and financial interest. Do not say that the Republicans are the beast and the Democrats are not. They are equal in their capacity to undermine true democratic principles. In addition to the power of historical and social and racial anemia, they have reconstructed and circulated through their highly popular celebrity culture and its counterpart in corporate-driven news, television, radio, and entertainment to produce a culture of stupidity, censorship, and diversionary spectacle that represents the trivia of our bored lives. The forces of creating an authoritarian state are in full play in the United States and extend far beyond the shadow of a debased and corrupt politics, a set of complex forces working in tandem to slowly, insidiously erode the very foundation of a civic and democratic culture. Some of the most glaring issues are massive unemployment, a rotting infrastructure, the defunding of vital public services, the dismantling of social safety nets, expanding levels of poverty, especially for children, the imprisonment of huge numbers of targeted minorities, mainly of color. At the same time, a reign of lawlessness is overtaking the United States as police violence and state terrorism result in the killing of an increasing number of black men, women, and young people. But such a list barely scratches the surface. Institutions that were once designed to serve the public good now wage war against all things public. For instance, we have witnessed in the last 30 years the restructuring of public education as either a source of profit for corporations or an updated version of control modeled after prison culture coupled with an increasing culture of lying, cruelty, and corruption. In conclusion, a culture of thoughtlessness now drives the predatory formative culture that allows a range of anti-democratic tendencies to flourish, tendencies that embody a new and extreme form of lawlessness in a theater of cruelty. Civic literacy in the United States is not simply in decline, it is the object of scorn and derision. The corporate-controlled media have abandoned even the pretense of holding power accountable and now primarily serve as a second-rate entertainment venue, spouting the virtues of balance, consumerism, greed, and American exceptionalism. Let us now go to my guest who is standing by and say hello to Kermit Herzog in California. Nice to have you with us today, Kermit.
Thank you, Gary, for having me on your show. And I've just listened to a powerful message given by you these past few minutes. Very powerful.
Thank you. Kermit, the current Ukrainian crisis and the new Cold War standoff between the United States and Russia over the Ukraine is not a momentary blip in the history of U.S. Eastern European relations. Ukraine has been a strategic geopolitical interest for America's imperial interventions for a long time, particularly as the former national security advisor for President Carter, Brzezinski, and later as a strategic consultant for Obama and Hillary Clinton. And the Ukraine's role in Brzezinski's grand chessboard scheme is pivotal. So please begin with some of the past background about the role of the Ukraine in the U.S.'s confrontational agenda with Russia, and in what ways has Brzezinski influenced Obama's position towards Russia, and finally the role of the right-wing neocon contingent and their supporting neocon on the left, which handpicked the Ukraine's new leaders and its agenda to ignite a larger conflict with Putin. The forum is yours.
Okay. I think we start here with basically how has the West brought itself to this position? And I'll start off with how has it been so thoroughly checkmated? And this is basically a rundown of the leaders we have and why we are where we are. In my opinion, the reasons are pretty clear. Western leaders have unfortunately been replaced by ideologues, sycophants, and political courtesans, to, if I may be accurate. Money determines their course of action, what or who they listen to or don't listen to, and their morality or immorality. In truth, the more accurate definition of our leaders would be replacement stewards, because they're really not leaders. Ukraine really is a glaring example of this really having gone to the dogs. But let's get back to the types of leaders. And basically, these are the people that have set us up in what is a dramatically and quickly deteriorating situation with, as Professor Cohen, Professor Chomsky, and others have said, is a slippery slope to thermonuclear war. But our ideologues adhere to their ideology, regardless of the facts or the changing world circumstances. The sycophants and the courtesans are beholden to their masters, oligarchs, or the highest bidder briber. And the Western oligarchs, this is characterizing who these people are dangerously out of touch with reality and only interested in their anachronistic fiefdoms in many cases, so their profits. So their strategy is at best stale, and this is the 1%. Thus, at the highest levels, our leaders are generally poorly qualified, deathly afraid of pragmatism, generally unethical, but worst of all, and the reason that I point to for being where we are in Ukraine, is that we are completely bereft of diplomats, or those who have diplomatic skills at the highest level of government. Our diplomats will call a world leader a Hitler, a Satan, a thug, ugly even. very quickly, just after they've shaken that leader's hand and just before they plot regime change to kill that world leader in his or her own country. And this is not a diplomat, and this is the major source of the problem that we have going on right now in Ukraine. We were not gifted with statesmen and diplomats to help avoid this and to see the grand chessboard strategy for what it is, a failed ideology.
Okay. Yes, I appreciate that insight. But explain, if you would, add on, please, how this entire conflict has been orchestrated and then blamed exclusively upon Russia and not showing that we needed this conflict. This is a regime change in the Ukraine. And how? What was our motive? Why would we want to risk a confrontation with Russia? We could never beat Russia. We couldn't. Look what we didn't do in we didn't do it in Vietnam. We didn't do it in in Afghanistan and Iraq. Do you really think, anyone really think, that we're going to go in there with one of the largest, most sophisticated armies in the world and beat Russia? So what is our motive?
What we're witnessing in Ukraine is the final, or the finale, of the grand chessboard strategy made flesh. And if I may say up front, the results of which, metaphorically speaking, are entirely indistinguishable from what Mary Shelley wrote in Frankenstein. It's all gone horribly wrong. But the grand chessboard strategy that really began its life as the Heartland Theory in 1918 by Sir Halford Mackinder has turned out to be a colossal failure. And whether it was methodology or the actual theory itself really doesn't matter. What does is that the ongoing drama in Ukraine has the near-term potential to make Vietnam and even World War II appear small blips on the history of warfare and death. But regarding a few ways or a few of the important points that the West tried to establish via its grand chessboard strategy, the first was to exert control over Eurasia via the control of Russia's geopolitical, geostrategic, and geofinancial destiny, and thus to isolate it, and this extends to China as well. The goal, to keep them vassals of the West and powerless. Mackinder referred to this as the Heartland Theory, wherein if you controlled the heartland of Eurasia and Africa, then you were the power. You were the person in charge. Well, this has not turned out exactly as they would have liked it to, but let's go on to some of the other tenets that they tried to establish. The second was to control Europe, ostensibly as a vassal state to U.S. power and its relationship with Russia, by the division of Eurasia via a renewed Cold War, what we are seeing unfolding along a new Iron Curtain that has magically moved right up to Russia's border, though there are those within NATO and the West who would like you to believe that it was the other way around and that Russia somehow magically moved towards its borders, its NATO bases. And the third point, the reason why this goes on to date, despite the many failures, is to enshrine U.S. hegemony via the dollar's role as reserve currency, petrodollar, and to thereby guarantee the use of strong-arm diplomacy by the West in the form of we take what we want when we want it, for at least a while. And these are the key tenets that really have us driving eastward, that have us assuming Poland and Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia, and a good number of others, really, based on this grand chessboard strategy, have either been checkmated already or will be in the near term, again, as a direct result of this final chessboard gambit. If I may recount how they've been checkmated, Russia right now is far from being isolated or controlled, as witnessed by its active participation in numerous and growing geopolitical, geostrategic, and geofinancial organizations. The BRICS organizations, the BRICS banks, the Eurasian Union, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Asian Infrastructure Bank are all testaments to Russia's full integration of what's being called the ultra world. And our leaders, again, I can't really call them leaders, they're more stewards, really have no clue of what's happening, as demonstrated by the grand board chessboard strategy that has allied Russia. This is very big. The country with the largest supply of nuclear missiles in the world, at this point, superior weapons technology, and I can touch on that if you like shortly. an incredible natural gas resources with China, the country that has the world's largest GDP, tremendous capital reserves, and a manufacturing infrastructure that will soon be, if it isn't already, second to none. Add to the mix, Russia and China have to date negotiated over $1 trillion in win-win business deals. The importance of this, those contracts were all denominated in yuan and rubles, not dollars. This, again, is the mother of all fails or checkmates for the architects of the grand chessboard strategy. But there's much more. So they forge ahead with this strategy, and they lose every consecutive time. But number two are the hairline fissures that began running through the EU at the start of the U.S.-Ukrainian coup. Well, they're now turning into very noticeable fractures. A number of EU multinationals openly defy the embargoes against Russia, and EU leaders increasingly voice their opposition by way of their respective medias, intellectuals, and their business class. The fractures widen every day. This is a check waiting to be a checkmate. Another thing that is basically unfolded as a result of the grand chessboard strategy, or the failure of its implementation, is that Western financial institutions, the World Bank, the IMF, Wall Street, the rating agencies, and even the SWIFT systems are all challenged now by rivals from the East, developed by new best friends for life, Russia and China. Interestingly enough, compelled into each other's arms by the West, another catastrophic fail. So this really is what is happening. The main tenets of this strategy have been and are being defeated, and I understand why this is causing great consternation now and why they know nothing other but to wrap up, because their policies over the past 50 years have been predicated on warfare, not diplomacy. So that, I guess, kind of explains how those tenets, you know, have fallen to the wayside, so to speak.
I appreciate these insights, and you've given us the larger picture. So we best understand the takeaway message for us is that the United States has been posturing behind the scenes in front of the world. They just have this ongoing obsession with power, and there's just no way that we're going to checkmate Russia and China. And now Russia and China are working together, and we are clueless. But the neocons have always been clueless, so the people who got us into the Iraq war are the same people who'd love to get us into another war. And you're saying, Kermit, these are not the people we should believe. We should not look at the old grand chessboard, as your book says, Ukraine, as a big grand chessboard and how the West was checkmated. And you are right. And I thank you very much for your scholarship and for your tenacity on letting us know the truth, irrespective of what the mainstream media refuses to accept. All the best on this. And the website is taynelane.com. Look forward to our next conversation, Kermit. Yeah. Look forward to our next conversation. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.